When media and tech companies try to capture your attention, their ultimate goal is to make money, either directly from you or from some advertiser to whom they can sell your eyes and ears for a little while. But your attention is also a medium for artists, an integral part of the finished product of any creative work that doesn't really gain meaning until it is shared. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Today we're going to focus on focus and the surprising ways art can sometimes play with our attention by forcing us to make the effort to concentrate. New Yorker contributor Kyle Chayka has put together a short list of some works that do this for an essay in Believer magazine titled Time Well Spent. Kyle, welcome back to Think.
Thanks for having me again.
We often talk about attention as a commodity, and you think about it more as a state of mind. What's the important distinction there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, as you said, when we're on the internet, our attention is constantly being manipulated and like pulled in different directions, and we're distracted by every single new thing. But in this piece, I wanted to get back to the idea of attention as like a single state of mind in which you are actually paying attention to something instead of like your attention being denied or constantly pushed away.
What are the rewards for making that effort to pay attention?
I mean, I think we understand things by paying attention to them. I like to think of attention as something that's not an immediate judgment, but an attempt to actually sit with something and experience it and kind of give it its full due. And then once you have paid attention to it, then you can kind of judge it and figure out what it means to you after the fact.
How much control do you think we have as individuals over our own attention?
That's a great question. I think there are always certain things that compel our attention immediately. You know, like the busiest, flashiest, most extravagant stuff is really easy to pay attention to. But I think the more rewarding forms of attention are paid to things that are more subtle or maybe are more appealing to you personally. And that could be like a piece of art or music, or even just, you know, going on a hike or being outside.
So artists have always sought, as you say, to manipulate our attention. Do you think they had an easier time of that before modern media came to dominate almost every waking minute of our lives?
Yes, I think they did have a much easier time of it. I mean, I think back to the form of the 19th and 18th century history painting, which was kind of the equivalent of today's blockbuster movie, except it was just an enormous painting on a wall that the public would congregate around and look at and dissect, you know, for hours on end. And we would just never do that today because we have so many options for entertainment and stimulus, you know, from our phones to our TVs to the internet and everything.
What I think is really interesting is that artists are not necessarily setting out to make focus easy for us. What did the avant-garde composer John Cage say about boredom?
So he liked to play with attention a lot. And I think what he said about boredom was that if something is boring after 2 minutes, try it for four. If it's still boring, try it for 8, 16, 32, and so on. Eventually, one discovers that it's not boring at all, but very interesting. So it's kind of this argument that the longer you pay attention to something, the more interesting and rewarding it gets, no matter if you think it's initially exciting or cool.
Yeah, there's real wisdom there, and yet it also sounds like a punishment, I think, to a lot of us.
Absolutely. I mean, it is punishing, and it can be really difficult to pay sustained attention to anything. So I think this is kind of like a meditative act to focus on a single thing for so long.
You point out that we have so many distractions now from boredom that lots of us feel like we need a second screen on hand when we're watching TV. I mean, how does that affect our ability to really experience any show or movie on its own?
I think it kind of destroys that, or at least gives us the option of always opting out of it. And I mean, I can only describe my own experience, but there are TV shows or movies that I constantly look at my phone during, unfortunately. And I think, you know, from my view, some kinds of content has actually adapted to that situation and become like less immediately engaging, maybe more ambient, so that you can look at your phone and experience the thing on TV at the same time.
So your point in this essay is that there are artists urging us to swim upstream through our boredom just to see what we might find. And so I want to talk about them. The first work you present is Erik Satie's composition Vexation, which was written in the late 19th century. Before we hear a little of that, tell us what Satie did that nobody had tried before.
He invented this thing that he called furniture music, which was specifically music that you were not supposed to pay attention to. So it was music that should exist in the background and provide kind of a nice environment or ambiance for a situation. Though in the case of Vexations, this is kind of a more abstract piece that he scribbled a little note on the composition that maybe you should play this 840 times in a row.
Was he joking or was he serious?
No one really knows. The composition was discovered after his death, but it was only first staged by John Cage, who, in a kind of absurd way, took the 140 times very seriously.
Do we know if there were some reasons that he didn't want his work to command our focus?
I mean, I think to me, it was kind of a rebellion against the music of the era. It was this rebellion against very dramatic, you know, what we think of classical music being, you know, a symphony in a theater that you're sitting there paying attention to. I think his way of getting away from that was to make a more casual composition, to have something that loops in the background of a social experience. And he actually did make compositions for specific social experiences, like, you know, a party at a grand house or in a garden. So I think it was his way of almost coloring the environment with music instead of making it the focus of attention.
All right, let's let Vexations roll for about a minute here. You, Kyle Chaika, actually attended a live staging of this piece of music at the Guggenheim. Tell us what that experience was like.
Yeah, I'm surprised they let you play that on the radio. So when I saw it staged at the Guggenheim a few years ago, it was, you know, the situation in the basement of the Guggenheim, and they had an array of maybe a dozen pianists taking turns playing this little looping composition over and over again, I think in the end for about 17 hours straight. And I was there for, I think, 4 or 5 hours. And, you know, I would kind of drift in and out of sleeping and kind of have these hallucinations created by the music. It was very hard to pay attention to. And I don't think the point was to pay attention to it, the music itself, but it created this kind of very deeply surreal situation that stands out to me still.
Did you find yourself wanting to run out?
Definitely. I had to resist my own urge to escape the music. And at one point, I actually went to the cafe in the Guggenheim just to get a break. And it turned out they were piping the live sound into the cafe. So there was no escape from Satie in that situation.
Where did your mind go as you were listening or not listening?
I mean, certainly, I think I was thinking about the art itself and kind of what I found melodic or discordant in the composition. I also thought a lot about how the different pianists played the composition, because they each kind of had their own little spin on it, and they would play it faster or slower. But it was kind of hard to think about anything, honestly. I think it was just something about that composition erases thought.
All right, I want to talk about this unsurprisingly never released video game created by the magicians Penn and Teller. What was the object of this game exactly?
Yeah, so this game was called Desert Bus, and it was kind of a truck driving simulator, or a bus driving simulator, I suppose. and you take the trip in the video game for an 8-hour ride from Tucson to Las Vegas and back again. But the trick is, in the video game, this trip happens in real time, so it actually takes 8 hours. And the truck has a slight drift, so you always have to be correcting for it on the steering wheel. And that just creates like a very painful second by second sense of focus.
All right, here is Penn Jillette talking about it at the start of the game.
Sure, I guess there's a chance you'll be on a major commercial airliner and have to take over for an unconscious pilot. Or maybe after all those years of expensive schooling your parents worked so hard to put you through, you'll decide to chuck it all to enter the Indianapolis 500. It could happen. But for most of us, the chances are slim to none. Teller and I want to prepare you for the real world. We want to show you what life is really like. Desert Bus is the first in our line of what we like to call Vera Simulators, games stupefyingly like reality.
So it's obviously a joke, right? But there's also a kind of commentary on the contrast between our expectations from entertainment and, frankly, from life, and then the banality of actual existence.
Totally. We expect entertainment to be entertaining. Like, we expect a video game to be action-packed and provocative, or we expect a blockbuster movie to be, you know, overwhelming and dazzling. But in this case, it's like the most boring, mundane experience possible through entertainment.
So here's how the game plays out. So that is like the kind of music you expect at the start of some racing game, and then just for 8 hours, if you can get through it, the drone of that bus. Now, we actually found that video online. So somebody managed to get their hands on a copy and play the whole thing and then put it on YouTube. I'm at least as curious about who has watched the video as who has bothered to play it.
Right. It does remind me of slow TV, which is another funny form of attention and entertainment. And that's like videos, for example, of a Norwegian train going through the mountains for 5 hours straight. And this was kind of like a popular meditative kind of video, maybe, you know, 5 or 6 years ago.
Are you someone who meditates, by the way?
I'm not. I think I'm more interested in it conceptually than I am in practice, but I think I probably should more.
Well, I don't either. And it seems I have a son who's really into it, and he's constantly extolling the virtues. And people who start to meditate can't stop talking about how great it is, but the rest of us find even the idea like really hard to get our heads around.
Yeah. I mean, I think it takes a lot of discipline. And maybe once you undertake that discipline, one, you want to talk about it, and two, you find it very satisfying to practice, since it's such a stark contrast from the rest of our lives.
And I guess it really does. It feels like an achievement to push through boredom.
Yeah, I think it really is, especially when we have so many options not to. Like, we can turn to any kind of stimulation at any second. I mean, honestly, personally, I find going on hikes to be quite boring, and I'm proud of myself when I, you know, push through that and can, you know, enjoy the forest and think about nature for a while.
I'm curious for you as a writer. I mean, lots of people out there talk about wanting to write, and the reason that I think most people who want to write are not writers is that they can't make themselves write. Like, what is your relationship to the space and the silence you need to actually put something into words?
I mean, the question of whether writing is boring is a good one. I think for me, writing is not boring because I find it to be a kind of puzzle. Like, I want to express something or tell a particular story, and I need to figure out the best way of doing that. And like, mentally, it's not so painful for me, I guess. It's more this particular process and detail of assembling a picture and putting all the words together. So I find writing itself kind of calming and meditative, actually, at least when it's going well.
When you read other writing that you don't care for, that you find dull, have you been able to like identify what doesn't work about it?
Well, I definitely have my own taste in writing. And I think my taste tends toward the kind of calm and slow. But I think what bothers me in writing, I suppose, is a sense of messiness and the sense that the writer hasn't planned for what's going to happen or doesn't care about the reader's experience. I guess I always want to feel connected to the writer as a reader and vice versa, like to connect to readers as a writer. And when that's missing, it bothers me.
All right. I was surprised to find Nintendo's Pocket Pikachu on this list. For those of us who don't fall into like the exact demographic sweet spot to have been the right age when it came out, explain this to us.
Yeah, I was the exact demographic, I suppose, because the Pocket Pikachu came out in 1998, which was just after the original Game Boy games in America. And so the Pocket Pikachu was a little Tamagotchi-like thing, which is a little plastic device that you carry with you, and it's a little virtual pet that you take care of and feed and play with and stuff. And so I had mine, I think, right at the end of elementary school. And it was definitely the first experience I had of technology that was always there, always with you, and kind of always on.
So you didn't, it didn't necessarily require your attention at every moment, but you had to kind of keep it in the back of your mind, right?
You had to think about what the little pet was doing and how you could keep earning points and help it evolve and things like that. So there was a sense of progress and investment, I think, that I don't want to link it to like Twitter followers now, but there's kind of a link. You want to get more likes, you want to get more points.
It is funny when you go when you've posted something and you go back to see sort of how it's doing and whether people have you know responded in any way. It is a little bit like earning a prize of some kind in a game.
Totally. I think there's like an incentive structure to a lot of social media experiences now that keeps you coming back and keeps you engaged. So, you know, when you put out something and no one pays attention to it and no one likes it, you're kind of sad and discouraged. But then when something does blow up intermittently and everyone likes it and is excited about it, then you get that urge to keep going and like play the game again, I suppose.
So you remind us of this 2010 video work by Christian Markley called The Clock, which is categorized as a piece of durational artwork, which is not a term I'd been familiar with. How does this play out?
Yeah, durational artwork is kind of shorthand for video art. And so this was not one video, but instead Christian Markley assembled clips from, you know, hundreds of different movies and TV shows and films, I think. And each clip references the time of day in some way. So it might show a clock, or it might show an actor looking at their watch, or someone speaking the time of day. And he stitched that into a whole record of one day through films.
And you found this really hard to turn away from.
Right, it's just constantly enchanting because you're always looking for the next reference to time. You're always trying to figure out where it's going to come from and what he's found.
The time thing is really interesting here because we don't spend a lot of, pardon the pun or whatever it is, we don't spend a lot of time thinking about the passage of time, except when we think that it's going too quickly, right? And yet, the thing that makes time pass more slowly, which is not being just fully engaged, is often really hard for us to cope with.
Yeah, it's such a weird contrast. Like time passes most quickly when you're enjoying yourself the most, probably. And then what makes you focus on it and what makes you slow down is either an obstacle in your way or some kind of difficult experience. So I think in this case, Christian Markley's piece is about focusing on time itself and making us more aware of that passage without, you know, the painful experience or seeing time through culture, maybe.
How long did you experience The Clock by Christian Markley?
I think I stayed in there for an hour and a half or 2 hours the first time. And it's just because it's so easy to keep following. And there isn't that sense, as in some video art, that you have to push through it and kind of survive.
Yeah, there are those video pieces where you're waiting for things to come into focus, and they may or may not deliver that for you.
Totally. And then this is kind of like an I Spy game or Where's Waldo, where you're always looking for the clock. And I think, as we might talk about next, like the clippy nature of it resembles social media in some ways.
Right. So since 2016, we've had TikTok, which plays with attention in an entirely different way. It seems to ask nothing of our attention since we can instantly get something new. And yet, there is this like algorithm at work making predictions about what we like based on how long we spend watching, and we don't end up being in control of what shows up.
I think TikTok is trying to absorb as much of your attention as possible in any way that it can. And I th that it accomplishes that through its design quite a bit because the videos are full screen. You can swipe through them with one motion of your finger, and there's always something new. Like, you never get to the end of your feed or run out of stuff to consume. And that's because the For You page algorithm is always measuring what you're engaging with and how long you're engaging, and then using that to offer you up some new content that you might be interested in.
There's another irony there in that we can all lose time with this sort of thing, even if we're not specifically on TikTok. And yet, most of us feel like we don't have enough time to get things done.
I think it absorbs a lot of time. I mean, TikTok is very immersive, and social media in general is super immersive, and its incentive is to absorb more and more of our time. You know, it's not good for Facebook if you spend less time on Facebook. So I think there are some incentives there that are bad for the user. Like, the technology is trying to absorb more of our attention and keep us on there, so it can monetize that attention and ultimately make more profit.
Could we fix this with regulation, or is this the kind of thing that we all just need to take responsibility for ourselves?
I think there is a level of personal responsibility where, you know, we don't play video games all day. We shouldn't be on TikTok all day. But I do think that regulation should play a big role in this, principally through hopefully making algorithmic feeds more transparent and giving the user more control over what they're recommended and when. And I also personally think that breaking up some of the larger social media companies could also create more competition and then maybe encourage the companies to give users more agency.
I'm curious, Kyle, how you feel about distraction as really demotivating the creation of art. If there's always something else out there that someone else has put forth for us, we don't necessarily need to make anything of our own, do we?
No, I think that's totally a feeling that a lot of people have. I mean, when the internet kind of offers up an infinite range of stuff and anything kind of exists if you look for it, you maybe are discouraged from making something on your own, or there's this feeling that you can't come up with anything original. And if you aren't original, is it really worth doing anything at all? But you know, I don't think that's the case. I think ultimately everyone has their own personal expressions of stuff, and we shouldn't just assume that every flavor of everything has already been done.
How often do you find things that feel like art when you scroll through TikTok or head to YouTube?
Not very often. I wish that I had that feeling more, though I don't think it doesn't happen. I think lately I've been encountering these artists on TikTok who make very surreal computer rendered cartoons. And when I see those in the TikTok feed, it reminds me that new things are possible and that there's new ways of telling stories through this medium. I think there was one account that posted 3D cartoons that were almost a form of role playing, where this cartoon figure was trying to escape a room and would follow the instructions of the commenters on TikTok. And that just struck me as something totally unprecedented and different that nonetheless like existed within the medium itself of TikTok. And that was pretty astounding.
Okay, we're about to listen to a bit of the YouTube channel Lo-Fi Hip Hop Radio. Before we turn that on, what is the point of this music?
The point of this music, I think the full title of this YouTube channel is Lo-Fi Hip Hop Radio Dash Beats to Relax Slash Study To. And I think that kind of says it all. It's like background music for studying or reading or kind of doing anything that you maybe don't particularly like.
Thank you. All right, that was lo-fi hip-hop radio beats to study or relax to. I have to say, it stresses me out because I feel like I'm waiting online for someone at AT&T to provide tech support. Like, I keep expecting, you know, your call is very important to us. Please stay on the line. But, I mean, it's nice enough music. Why is it better than silence, do you think?
To me, it fills some part of my brain that would otherwise be anxiously looking for another thing. Like, maybe we're so overstimulated generally now that this kind of provides that one slight distraction that you need. It's like enough new content or enough stuff going on in the background so that you can actually focus on what you're trying to do.
Are you able to write while music is on?
Oh yeah, definitely. In fact, during the pandemic specifically, I would often write with lo-fi hip-hop radio on. I think because it was just so nothing, so blah, like it didn't make me feel anything or think about anything. It was just a way to, like, a soft mental cloud that I could exist in while I was doing something.
And you also discovered there's this, like, little online community that forms in the comments, right?
Mm-hmm. On the YouTube channel itself, there's always this real-time scroll of people posting and being like, I'm studying right now, you know, what are you guys up to? Or just saying where they're listening from, whether it's, you know, Brazil or London or whatever. And I find that comforting as well, because it shows that there's a bunch of people who are in a similar situation to you maybe, or listening to the same thing that you are, which is the feeling that you get from radio, but not necessarily from the internet.
I'm curious about what happens when you, I mean, this is not a piece about boredom, and it's certainly not a boring essay, but I wonder if you had to pitch this to your editors in a different way than you might pitch another kind of piece.
I mean, it took this form of a list of specific works. And I think that's part of what paradoxically makes it more fun and interesting. So if I proposed it to you that it was just going to be a long block of text and you would have to read through the whole thing with no interruptions, that might sound kind of boring or difficult. But to instead say, okay, it's these 9 works that play with your attention in different ways, that's much more approachable and actually feels kind of internet-y. Like, it's a classic listicle.
Do you find editors looking for shorter and shorter pieces now? I know you write a lot of long form stuff. I wonder if it's harder to find places that want to publish that.
I think it is. I mean, there are different varieties of content on the internet. And so some websites will publish shorter pieces and some websites will publish longer. I think over the past, you know, 5 years, maybe, there's been a big realization that actually long written features and really in-depth journalism actually does attract big audiences. And it also draws readers closer to the author and the publication. So I'm happy that lots of places have been investing in longer writing, and hopefully readers are paying attention to it as well.
Your particular career is so interesting in terms of, like, your relationship to disconnected time, right? Because you have to need space to think and write, but you're often paid to think and write about stuff that commands attention.
Yeah, it's kind of a double awareness that you have to have. But I know when I think enough about something, when an idea is just so stuck in my head, I know that I have to write about it. And those ideas that I kind of obsess over and just keep coming back to me are usually the ones that I write the best about and connect with readers the most over.
Have you learned to stop fearing that you're missing out on something else that someone else has written, produced, you know, put out there for consumption? I mean, you can't possibly get it all in, right?
No, I mean, I have a million internet browser tabs open right now and 100 articles I'd like to read. But I think we all have to kind of focus on what's most interesting to us or what's closest to our hearts. So the stuff that I really try to read the most about is, you know, things about technology that I'm interested in, or like art and culture that I like.
Do you think we are going to continue making progress and making things that are truly creative and have not existed before?
That's a huge question, and honestly, I think there's a lot of signs that culture is getting more repetitive and more homogenized, specifically through these huge digital platforms that we're all kind of stuck on. Like, there's Netflix is continually re-releasing TV shows with new actors or repeating stories. Marvel movies just happen over and over and over again. There are tons of historical biopics and stuff going on. And I kind of fear for new things. I fear that new things can't be heard as easily and original ideas have a more difficult time of getting audiences right now.
Kyle Chayka is a contributing writer at The New Yorker. His essay about art and attention titled Time Well Spent was published by Believer magazine. Kyle, thanks very much for making time for us again.
It's great to talk to you.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. If you want the podcast to fill up your free time, you can find it wherever you get podcasts by searching for KERA Think, or you can listen directly from our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.